Now I'd like to introduce to you Jeremy Pruitt, the head football coach of the Tennessee Football Volunteers.
My vision for our football team is we want to be a big, fast, dominating, aggressive, relentless football team that nobody in the SEC wants to play. That's my goal.
The Tennessee Volunteers are coming off an off week after defeating Kentucky at Kentucky. A pair of 5-5 teams will square off in Columbia, Missouri as Tennessee travels to Missouri. Dan Harrelson here alongside Coach Rush Probst. Coach, just kind of talk about this Tennessee team. Jeremy Pruitt on Monday kicking off the game week against Missouri. Seemed pretty good. Said he had a good off week, so that's good to know and hear. Heading into a game where you can become bowl eligible, and same situation as last year, two games left, you're sitting at 5 wins. Just need to get one win for that bowl game, and I feel pretty good about this compared to last year. I think, as we saw in that Kentucky game, it was not pretty at all, but this team, as we kind of discussed in October, they're starting to learn how to win, and that's what they did at Kentucky.
Yeah, I think learning how to win is what's sustaining them a little bit right now. And I think it goes back to what Jeremy's been saying, his foundation, you know, and him building a culture and a foundation to win. And he's stuck with his plans. I mean, you can say what you want. People can debate it and scrutinize it all you want. But at the end of the day, you got to give him credit that he's stuck with his plan of what he's wanted to do. Whether people would do it different ways or whatever, but he's bound and determined to do it his way, and it's working. And I think that as ugly as it was in the Kentucky game, because both offenses were so anemic, you know, and it was sometimes, you know, boring for the fans to watch. But, you know, it is, you know, Kentucky's offense is not very good. And limited, very limited. And then you throw Tennessee in there, wasn't much better, but it was good enough. And good enough at this point in time in your program, what year two, to be sitting there, because we know as well as anybody there would be sitting here now at 7-3. And if they're 7-3, there's a whole different dynamic. But it is what it is. They've gotten past the rough start, they've got the boat sailing. And I think they're going, you know, to a tough environment on Saturday. We'll talk about it in a minute. But I just thought on Saturday, 2 weeks ago, I just thought that, you know, especially Tennessee just did things not to get themselves beat, you know, and try to keep themselves in the game. And I think that's why he went with Jerry Gattano, because, I mean, he gives them a chance to be solid in a base offense to where very little decision making's got to take place. And I mean, you know, he's just lets his players make some plays, and defensively they had to know going in that they were going to be good enough defensively to hold Kentucky down, because Kentucky is so anemic on offense. But again, I think Jeremy's done a great job of sticking to his base foundation of what he's wanting to do with Tennessee football going forward.
Yeah, and you mentioned Jarrett, and it seems like he's that top guy, and there's nothing wrong with this. It, like he says, whatever helps with the team to win,
right,
as he alluded to after that Kentucky win, that he doesn't mind if he's coming in the relief pitcher, that six-man role. And I think it would be great to see Maurer go ahead and get that nod to start the game again in Columbia and just see how it goes, and then put Jarrett in. Some guys kind of play a little bit better coming in as that relief pitcher.
You know, everybody needs a guy like Jarrett. I mean, let's face it. I mean, obviously the future of Tennessee down the road is probably, and I'm not, I mean, obviously we're analysts and, you know, people that are talking heads, but with Brian Maurer and then with Harrison Bailey, if he sticks with his commitment, I think that he will. He comes in, and it's a great battle for that spot. But Jarrett is sitting back in the wings, and he's got to be well liked by his teammates because of his attitude, which is contagious. So to be sitting there in that six man role, is that six man off the bench mentality, is, and the kid accepts that role, hey, you never know when you're first quarterback or whatever happens. And he's sitting there solid with a lot of experience coming in. I would like that situation as a coach. As an offensive coordinator, I would love to be in that situation. But a lot of times you see in the day of transfer portal, you know, there's so many kids now that if they're not starters at the quarterback position, they transfer. Well, I think with Jalen Hurt, what he did at Alabama, staying in Alabama, I think set a new standard. Hey, and then, you know, in doing what he did, I think Jared falls in that same character, and they can stay there and give Tennessee solidify the offense basically, and know that you've got two guys probably battling it out with him sitting there close, nipping at their heels, and it's great to have competition. But to me, you got three guys next year that can give you what you need.
Well, speaking of Harrison Bailey and his commitment, of course, but we do have that early signing period coming up next month in December. You were kind of associated with that on the high school end the last couple of years there at Colquitt as a head coach. Do you like it, or do you like just the traditional all in one day, all in one period in February?
You know, I didn't mind early signing period. I think what's tough on teams like us at Colquitt, they were constantly in a state championship or semifinal role. I mean, you know, in 9 of 11 years, we were in the state championship game 5 times, and in the semifinals 4 other times. So, and one time was in the quarters, so there was only 1 year that we didn't make the playoffs in our first year. So the problem with that is you're playing to that second week of December, so when do those kids go on their official visits? So in my deal, I would not let our kids during the season go on an official visit during the playoff run, especially come region play. So say about October 20th for us till we got through playing, which is around the second week of December, a week prior to signing day, I wouldn't let our kids go. And so here's what I told them. If you're going to sign early and you want to go and do this, you're going to do it in May, you're going to do it in June, or late July, or you can do it in September. You know, maybe that we had an open date right there at that first Friday in October, and that's when I really pushed him to do it. Is, you know, of course you had to dodge the ACT test, whenever it was, but that first week in October, I strongly encouraged him, or the last week in September, to do it. After that, I'd cut it off, because here's why. If you're trying to win a championship in high school football, which that's your ultimate goal, it's team goals, not individual goals. And so we had 136 to sign, Dan, over a 10-year period, 137 total. We had one the first year. So I had 136 kids, in those 10 years. So we had a lot of kids to sign. But the ultimate goal was to be the state champion. And so if they left to go on a visit November the 7th, or November the 9th, say the Alabama-LSU game, or to the Georgia-Tennessee, whatever. You know, that kid would leave, and he'd have to leave Friday night after the game. He'd get in late so he don't sleep. He's entertained the whole next day. He goes out with the players on Saturday night, wherever official visit he's at, so he don't get any sleep Saturday. And then Sunday, he has to hurry back, because we have team meeting at 2:45 on Sunday afternoons. You know, we have a weightlifting session, film session, and a headgear short practice. So they'd come back, you know, and I experienced this a couple of times, and they were dead tired. And I said, after about 2 or 3 years of that, I said, we're not doing this anymore. So we just cut it off. So I don't like it from that standpoint. I think when you look at really good programs throughout the in any state, I think you'll hear the same coach saying the same things. Now, I think it worked to our favor some with certain teams that were loaded with a lot of talent. I was, encourage them to go on an official visit because I knew that they would be worn out come the following week. So, you know, I don't like it from that perspective. I think if you're going to go early signing day, to me, let's do it a little earlier. I mean, I understand, you know, the college side of it, but I'm looking for the high school side of it. So I don't know that I'm for it. So to me, if I was going to do an early signing date, let's do it the first weekend in August or the last weekend in July or whatever. I mean, if they know, they know. But I'm one guy with an opinion. Or do it in early October. But I know they want official visits throughout the year. But let me say this. How much is a LSU, how much did Alabama coaches spend with those players on an official visit playing in that magnitude of a ball game? Very little time. And so I think if you're going to wrap a guy up in December, you've had him wrapped up since the late summer.
Right. And then you saw, I guess, in your case, J.J. Peterson, he was a guy that, I guess he kind of envisioned just go ahead and pulling the trigger at the, I guess it was the All-American game.
Yeah.
But some guys, I mean, quarterbacks, you're going to see those guys commit pretty much in December so they can go ahead and go through spring ball, most of them.
That's right.
But a lot of other guys, maybe some running backs or some offensive linemen, those top guys, maybe they're thinking, well, everybody else is committing early. I need to, too. So there could be some pressure at that point for some of these guys.
Well, last year we had Jay Ward, who's playing at LSU, is in a backup role right now as a true freshman at LSU, and then Cam Bales at Auburn. And both those kids went to those second signing period because they just wasn't, they didn't know because they hadn't been anywhere. You know, they'd done their summer stuff, but official visits, they'd been on unofficial visits. But they had not, because LSU didn't get on Jay till the season. You know, all of a sudden he starts playing ball, and, you know, all of a sudden they jumped on him about, you know, 1st of October and said, hey, we like this kid. We think we like this kid. So they went back and forth on it. So he never went on an official visit. So it was late. So he finally went on one in late January and signed. And we had a lot of kids like that. I mean, a ton of kids. I mean, J.J. Peterson was a different mode, but most of our kids, Dan, were three-star players, all the SEC kids. We've had two at Auburn, one at Alabama. We've had three at Georgia, one at Florida, one at Kentucky, three at Tennessee, two at Arkansas, one at South Carolina, now one at LSU, none at Ole Miss or Mississippi State or A&M or Missouri or Vanderbilt. But most of the SEC. And then we had the Florida State kid, and we've had two there. Cam Irwin, who starts for the Kansas City Chiefs, and then Ryan Fitzgerald, the kicker. And then we had one in Indiana. And I can go on and on. But I just, most of our kids got their official visits in January because most of them were three-star players.
Well, anything else to add heading into this Tennessee-Missouri game? We'll catch a break unless you got anything else on that, Coach.
Well, I just think going into this game, it's a game that which team can generate enough offense. I mean, when you look at it, if you're a Tennessee fan, you got to be a little scary. Missouri's beaten Tennessee pretty handily the last 2 years, so motivation should be on Tennessee's side. But, again, I think Missouri has scored, I think you said, 6 points in the month of November. So they are struggling offensively. You know, I've heard a lot of chatter over in Columbia with that particular situation on offense, but man, they're anemic. So Tennessee has a great opportunity here to go in there and sort of break that trend of Missouri beating them. But then again, the same token, Missouri is in desperation mode. They're 5-5. I think they end up with Arkansas. They got to sort of feel good about that one. They got a chance to get to 6 wins, but, man, you'd have to think they'd want to get to 7, but to get a little bit better bowl. So I think it's crucial. I think it's a good Saturday night SEC battle between two teams that are desperately seeking to win to get to bowls, and if Missouri is allowed to go to a bowl. But again,
I think that's the interesting part, because they still have that appealing process. Of course, we don't know what's going to happen now until that Sunday coming up when all the bowl games are announced. I don't think anything will be handed down or that appeal process will end by then. So it will be interesting to see when that comes down if they go ahead and accept a bowl bid.
I agree. But I just think Tennessee's in a good posture right now. You know, a team that's beat you pretty soundly, and you've had 2 weeks to prepare, and you're on a little bit of a momentum swing right now, winning football games late. So, I mean, you got to lean to Tennessee. But then again, it scares you because Missouri is desperate. So they're either going to come out and play. I think Missouri comes out and plays either really, really good or really, really bad. I don't think there's any in between here. I think Tennessee will get on them and rail them a little bit, or either Missouri will come out and look like they hadn't looked in probably since mid-September. So who knows?
All right, Coach, we're going to hit a break and come right back and talk more football. Lipscomb head coach Trent Dilfer and Super Bowl champion joins the show now. Coach, thank you for coming on and talking about what you're doing these days. Of course, your first year at Lipscomb as the head coach there in Nashville. You're in the playoffs. Just talk about the first season and how you've kind of adapted that transition into a head coach.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. I'm excited to do this with y'all. And yeah, it's been it's really been the thrill of my life. Outside of raising a family and being married for 26 years, this has kind of been the coolest thing I've been able to do. And people say, well, wait a second, you played 14 years in the NFL and TV and Elite 11, all this stuff. But this has been the coolest because the impact we've been able to have on a community. I say we because it's taken everybody. I'm just a part of it. But really going into a community where football wasn't that important. They had won 3 games in 2 years. The senior class had kind of been broken because of the failures that they have gone through, and to really see them grow as a community, see them grow as a football team, see them get just exponentially better through the season has been so much fun. We call it a human development program. Mass is a high school football team, and we've kind of taken that approach and embraced it. And man, it's been so much fun. It's been hard. It's been really, really, really hard. But as I tell the kids all the time, hard things are good things, and the more hard things we can tackle, then the better we're going to be. And that's kind of the approach we've taken.
Trent, Rush Probst, it's an honor to have you on. But I want to ask you first and foremost. I guess we'll jump right into it. You know, being a first-year head football coach, I know it comes with a lot of other things outside of just the true X and O. You know, if you could just walk in there and go in the offensive war room and sit down and just X and O and film study and all that, it'd be a great job. But there's a lot of other things that come with it because you're the head guy. What's the things that you feel like outside of the offensive side of the football? I know you had to hire coaches, and that comes with a different mindset of what you got to do, the right fit for the right place. There's a lot of things that go into that mixture of the right assistant coaches. But flip the head coaching hat on you. What's different? I mean, what have you found that you maybe wasn't ready for, or it hit you like a ton of bricks, or maybe you adapted well? So how was it being a head coach and being away from just the offensive side? What was your challenges?
Yeah, how long do we have? I mean, you know, even 30 years, you've done this as a head coach. I think 36, you said you've been coaching. I mean, I was a son of a coach, so I think that helped. I think being a quarterback helped, but nothing could prepare me for, like you said, all the other things. And we have a motto around here, just about figured outness. It's a term I made up years ago, but I think it's so relevant that you better have high figured out-and-outness, because every day you're going to have to figure something out. And I think the biggest thing I figured out is that everybody's issue is the biggest issue in the world to them, and it becomes your issue. So, not problem, just issue. So, you have, you know, we say we have 110 people in this tribe when you account for coaches, auxiliary staff, managers, players, and, you know, we're one big tribe, and if a manager has an issue going on, it becomes your issue. If a mom has an issue, it becomes your issue. Obviously, the players' issues are your issues. But then that extends up on campus. When, you know, academics has an issue, it becomes your issue. When student life has an issue, it becomes your issue. It goes on and on and on. And it was pretty overwhelming early on to want to do football, want to coach coaches, want to install systems, want to develop players, want to develop character, and yet 80% of my margin was taken away, taken from me with just managing issues. And at some point, I just embraced it. I said, you know, if this is it, if this is what I've been called to do, then I'm going to handle that. And I've tried to enjoy that and really look at it as education. A lot of times, people through their issues, but then also just being sensitive to it, understanding that, you know, in their family, whatever's going on, that's the biggest thing going on for them, and I need to meet them at that place and be able to work through whatever that is for the benefit of that family and for our football team.
Dan?
Yeah, talk about the facilities there at Lipscomb. I've seen videos online. I mean, it's just remarkable, a place like that that has, you know, an indoor facility and just really good facilities at a place like the Lipscomb Academy.
Yeah, they did a really good job building a strong foundation. They had good bones. The McAdams Indoor, especially, you know, state-of-the-art indoor facility, meeting space up top, coach's office, coach's suite, balcony, and then a 40 yard by 25 yard indoor turfed area. So that was in place. That had been years and years of fundraising, looking kind of forward to the future, and really wasn't being utilized. And, you know, when we came in, we obviously attacked the fundraising part of it, and you know, we were able to raise $1 million in 92 days, which is pretty remarkable, and the community really got behind us, and that allowed us, one, to pay our coaches. And the only way I said I'd take this job is if I could have a really robust coaching staff and be able to pay them significantly. But then to start, you know, attacking things like cleaning up and putting better facing on our present facility. So our locker room, adding a player's lounge. We have a barber shop, because we want to take care of our kids, and they work so hard, get them haircuts on Thursday night for free, and our coach's office, our coach's space, you know how important it is for coaches to have good workspace, so really dialing in their workspace. We built a state-of-the-art weight room. I was able to hire Luke Richardson, who has been to two Super Bowls with the Denver Broncos, won one as their human development coach, and then went to the Houston Texans, was their human performance coach there. They moved their family here to Nashville and was able to talk him to being our human performance director here. And his only request was, well, let's have the best high school weight room in the country. Well, we were able to go fundraise and be able to build that. So our next built us an incredible facility, and we actually have two on campus. So we have very good facilities. Our kids are well taken care of. We have a full-time nutritionist, a full-time academic coach. So pouring resources. My theory's been that if we're gonna have resources, let's exhaust them into the kid. Let's make sure they're not frivolous. Let's make sure the kid is experiencing the fullness of every resource we get. So whether it's academics, whether it's nutrition, whether it's, you know, emotional support, whether it's, you know, strength and conditioning, you name it, we want to have the best resources to give these kids.
You know, you said the thing that hit me hard right there was, Trent, is that you know, the ability to hire assistant coaches and to be able to fund that is a huge. At Hoover High School, it was a lot easier on me to raise money there. They were hungry in 99 when I went there. But when I got to Coffee County, they've been able to put together a staff is such a critical aspect of that. My wife was our nutritionist, hired by the school. Same situation. Our facilities here are phenomenal, but, you know, you can't, and I say this all the time, I've got 22 coaches that have worked for me that are now coaching college football. Three of them are head football coaches, Jeremy Pruitt, obviously Tennessee, and Bill Clark at UAB, and John Gross at Jacksonville State University, and I may be leaving somebody out, but Dan, help me on that. But I think the issue was being in a place that was bought in to not only you, not only to Trent Dilford, but the other things that go with building your high school football program, and that's bringing in quality people. And if you can sell, your administration and your community on that, it makes your job much easier.
Oh, no doubt. I mean, you know, when I first got here, again, there's a lot we had really had to educate the community. And what I kept telling them is, if we're going to do this, it is going to take everybody. And then people kind of rolled their eyes, like, yeah, it sounds like a cliche. And I kept saying, no, it truly is going to take everybody. This is a massive rebuild. And not everybody starts with your core assistant coaches, but it extends to so many other people, too.
Oh, yeah.
We have so many people that have volunteered their time to pour into this program and pour into these boys, or help the staff do their jobs better. But you got to hire the right people. And I was so fortunate. I lucked out on a couple, to be quite honest with you. You know, I got said no to three times in the hiring process for various reasons. And the people that are filling those spots, I can't believe they weren't my number one option to start with. I mean, they've just been incredible assets to us. I mean, you get Bruce Kittle, who, you know, was Bob Stoops' recruiting coordinator at Oklahoma, his offensive line coach, and developed three NFL offensive linemen in his time in Oklahoma. To get him as your offensive line coach in high school, and he's, you know, he also does a lot of our life skills stuff with the kids. He's 60 years old. He's been a lawyer. He's been an ordained pastor, and he's been a college football coach. And now he's sitting here, you know, coaching high school knuckleheads on offensive line play and mentoring them. That's been incredible. Jamie Graham, who was an All-American at Vanderbilt and UCLA and was a really good high school football coach around here. My receiver coach fell through. Next, you know, I was able to get him. And, you know, so I've been luck into these quality people, and then was smart enough to, when I was interviewing coaches, it was bigger than X's and O's. I mean, I knew, I was very honest what I was asking to get into, because it wasn't going to be easy. But getting the right kind of people with the right kind of intellectual property, but more importantly, the right kind of work ethic and hearts has really made this thing go. And we've grown a lot as a staff, too. That's what I really have come to appreciate. I'm sure you've done this so many times, Coach, and I'd love to pick your brain off air about this stuff, too. But, you know, we'll talk later on in the show, I'm sure, about growing as a football team as you build for the playoffs, but we've grown so much as a staff. Now we're starting to think the same thoughts and communicate yep. the same way and read each other's nonverbals and, you know when a guy needs a little space or know when a guy needs, you know, a little love. He's out, he's being overworked or he's got something going on at home or, you know, whatever it is. And I think us growing as a staff, having fun doing it, I think the kids see that, and they feed off that. And me and my offense coordinator this happened 30 minutes ago before we jumped on this call, and we had a little conflict out there. And, you know, we both are passionate people, and we're jawing at each other, but the kids don't freak out about it because they know that it's gonna be a one-off, and we're going to be fine, and we were hugging 20 seconds after it. But that takes work. That takes trust, and we've been able to, you know, get through a lot of those things and really grow as staff.
You know, the one thing I've learned from Bill Clark over the last, you know, I sort of help out a little bit at times when we talk in a consulting role that I played for his dad in high school, and then, of course, Bill, the head coach at UAB, and what he's done there has been remarkable. But
phenomenal what he's done.
Phenomenal. But bring it, the other one is Chip Lindsey was the fourth coach that I left out, head coach at Troy. I was talking to him earlier today, and, you know, each coach has an issue, but I think what's helped you, and it's got to be a huge deal. I know it was with Bill. I know it was. what that is with Jeremy, is your dads being head football coaches or being high school football coaches and being able to also pull from their knowledge a little bit. So you sort of knew a little bit, you know, what you were getting into because of that. But that's got to help you some, is being able to lean on people that maybe have done it before at that level. So did that help you at all with your dad?
Oh, massively. I literally grew up on the back of a blocking sled. When I go and I speak at corporate events or whatever, that's my opening line. Like, here's context to who you're talking to. I grew up on the back of a blocking sled. Like, every childhood memory, I was riding the sled while the bigs, you know, knocked it back. And seeing my dad interact with coaches and players and administrators and just doing the things that he had to do and just idolizing him while he did it, being able to now call him and say, hey, what about this issue? And then my mom was a 38-year educator, administrator, and coach. So she's actually been as helpful as my dad, just talking me through some of this stuff and talking me off the ledge, to be quite honest with you, early on, and telling me it's going to be all right and things are going to work themselves out and you can't win every battle. You know, that was her biggest thing, was like, yeah, pick them because you're not going to win them all. So make sure you prioritize those battles. And her wisdom and his wisdom really helped me through the process, and I couldn't be more thankful for their input as I've gone through this.
Well, I know, talking to all the guys that are now head coaches on a collegiate level, and I've got tons of them on a high school level that I've worked with, but that's, you know, and then obviously you're where you are today because of good parents and the influence they have. I know, and I'm not taking anything away from my mom and dad. I had great parents, super upbringing, and but, you know, I played high school football in a small 1A school in Northeast Alabama. But I idolized my head football coach, and he's the reason I got into coaching, Reagan Clark, and that's Bill's dad. And I know that's the reason when things get real tough on Bill, like the loss to Southern Miss this past weekend where, you know, we couldn't hardly get a first down, you know, he can talk to, because he does a great job of telling his coaches to check their egos at the door when they get to the building, and you know how egos are. You've dealt with them all throughout your career. But he does a great job of that, and his dad did a wonderful job of that. I mean, you were going to be humble, and you learned those core values, or I did, from my high school football coach, and it's the reason I got into coaching. But changing the subject, what I'd like to ask you is, putting on your offensive coordinator or offensive hat, but I know I'm curious on this because of where the game has changed. You know, Trent, you know, 21 years ago, I started a program in Mobile named Alma Bright, and they had not won. It was a big 7A school in South Mobile County, very oppressed area. A lot of shrimpers, and long story short, we went 13-1, and it was a wonderful story. But I think going forward, you know, when you look at wherever you've been and what you've done, it seems like it comes full circle. So I guess what I'm saying is when we left Mobile, we were in a up-tempo offense. The spread. Now, I had a really good fullback or running back. Ended up going to Auburn as a fullback, all SEC player, and Brandon Johnson played a year for the Falcons. But when I went to Hoover, out of necessity, we threw the football like Brigham Young. I mean, we threw it just about every down. And people say, "Well, Rush, you just did that just to do that." And I tell people all the time, I did it because I didn't have a running back. We did not have a running back capable of playing 7A football. I don't think I had a running back capable of playing 1A football, but I had a quarterback. You could find guys that could throw. You could find guys that could catch. So with all that being said, where's the game? How much have you watered it down, or is it watered down? Because you know as well as I do, Trent, the game has changed in the down in the high school level than what you had when Xavier was playing years ago in the NFL.
So, really, talk about checking your ego. I had to check my ego when we started doing this with offense. I've been exposed to a lot of the greatest offensive minds that have ever coached football. I go on and on. And what I mean by checking my ego was I didn't want to come in as the guy with all the answers. And so I purposely hired an offense coordinator. His name's Trenton Kirkland. He was at Hutto High in Austin, Texas. He developed the Gatorade Player of the Year in Texas last year as a quarterback. Chase Griffin, who's now at UCLA. They put up 713 yards a game. Average 52 in Texas 5A. It wasn't 6A. It was really good 5A football. They lost, I think, in the semis. Chase broke his hand. Their quarterback broke his hand. And I hired him because I wanted to know more about the air raid. Of all the offenses that I've been exposed to or studied, that was the one I couldn't kind of put my finger on, you know, what the secret sauce of it was. So we immediately went and installed kind of an air raid base system. And he also has some Broyles ties, so he understands that kind of football, too. So he wanted to be a physical air raid. Right. Here's the challenge. And like you said, when you went to Hoover, we didn't have any offensive linemen. Our guys were wing T. They grew up in the wing T, so they still, you know, wing blocked, chicken wing blocked. They've never used their hands, never passed set. And we're looking at it going, well, yeah, we know we want to be, but what can we be? So what we've really become and what I've always felt is the best style of offensive football is to be a game plan offense. So we have, our roots are in the air raid. That's how our quarterback is trained. That's how our receivers are trained. But we'll play 22 personnel, and we're really good at it. We average 6.5 yards a carry in it. We'll get in 20 and run downhill and run on the edges and still use two-back air raid concepts. I'm a big run-action guy. You know, my roots are in deception, Kyle Shanahan, zone read, play action. I mean, zone run game play action, you know, pin and pull play action. So we can do that. And people say, well, you're trying to boil the ocean. And I think two things we've done. We've taught them football. We've taught them graduate-level football. These were kids that had maybe a first-grade math football experience until we got here, and we went from first-grade math to calculus. So they've learned a lot of football. There were some growing pains in that. But the other thing we're able to do is we tend to get the best looks in a game. You know, we can personnel, formation, motion, shift, whatever it is, to really give our kids an advantage with angles, spacing, activation of secondary players, whatever it may be. Like I said, there was growing pains. There's games where it looks like we can't walk and chew gum because at times they get too overwhelmed. But as we've built this thing, now the light's gone on. And they understand that we can, last week we were at 9 different personnel groupings, 13 different formations, ran 11 different runs, and I think we had 30 different pass concepts up. And that's kind of like a Power 5 menu. And that's what we talk about, is creating a menu each week that we could take to any of our pals in college football and say, hey, you know, this is what we were able to do in 4 days of preparation. Our boys know this. Can you do the same thing? Is this equal your menu? And we're proud of that. Now, again, if we were trying to win a state, you know, if we were in 7A football in Georgia or Alabama, probably couldn't do this, right? But rebuilding a program and trying to teach them football and creating a foundation offensively that we think will be lasting and really give us an advantage in years to come, that's kind of why we did it.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, a lot of people believe in the, you know, part whole. And I think what you're saying is you threw the whole gamut at them, and in the long run, and that's sort of, you know, what we did too, is that, you know, we struggled the first year at Hoover at 7-3, did not make the playoffs. Same thing in South Georgia, we go 4-6 and doesn't make the playoffs. But in that second year, because you did not carve anything back, and six national championships, and I mean, Lord, nearly 1,000 games. But so everything, there was no form of an air raid here at all. And, you know, but I think, you know, we came in and we struggled to start with multiple, like you said, multiple personnel groupings. But, you know, I guess the next question I have for you is that, but is it hard, Trent, to sort of, because in today's offensive world, if you can play with 12 personnel, but play empty, play 10 looks, play 11 looks, but have 12 personnel group, and if you don't have to change anything out, but you can play that, and that's hard to do, but if you can do that, isn't that a lot easier way to do it in today's world?
No doubt. If I had two tight ends, that's what I'd be doing. Yes. You know, if I had two, and again, they got to be the right tight ends. There's a school around here that's been really successful. I'm not going to use their name, but, you know, they're a 12 team, and they, but one of their tight ends is really just a glorified offensive lineman. So, you know, we were able to scheme against that. Wow. So they got to be the right guys. I mean, they got to be long. I think they got to be 6'3 plus. Okay. I think they got to have the ability to be dominant inline blockers. Otherwise, why not just play 11 or 10? They have to be able to get back in the backfield, because I do believe in having a fullback type player in short yardage. It also is so good for your play action game. And then to be able to go empty and give them those 10 looks, you know, run your tunnel screens. They got to be athletic enough to block on the perimeter. And as you've probably done, is it allows you to play fast. So the thing we've had to sacrifice is tempo. We wanted to play at about 12 to 14 seconds per play, and we're probably at 19 to 22, which is kind of slow. But it's best for what we're having to do. We start a 14-year-old at split end, who a true freshman, who's 6'3", 185, and runs 4'6". He'll play in the SEC. We have a sophomore tailback that's a power five back, but he's 16 years old. He's never played tailback. He was a wing T kind of, what do they call it, the wing guy. You know, so he was that jet guy. Now he's a downhill pistol back. We have a quarterback that had never played quarterback. He kind of played athlete, and he's 16 years old. We have two offensive linemen that are 16. So, you know, a lot of it was, you know, to try to play that fast and then stay in one personnel grouping. There's advantages at times, but the game also was too fast for them. So slowing it down a little bit, shifting personnel groupings and shifting formations and cutting the field in half for the quarterback, and actually cutting it in half for most of the players. But they didn't have to see the game through kind of this huge lens. They could see it through more micro. Okay, what's my job on this play? Let me do my job. I think it's been the best thing for us. But, man, if you dropped off two 6'4", 218-pound tight ends that could run and catch and block, I'd be in 12 all day long.
Yep, and I think that's, you know, we went from 9, 10, 11, 12, and 13. I got here in 8. And, Trent, we lost semifinal, state championship game, semifinal, semifinal, semifinal. Well, what turned it around is we had two tight ends, which is exactly what you're talking about. Once we got the ability to play 12 all the time in an up-tempo, and be able to give you every different look at known to man out of 12, it took it to a different level. And then we won 30 straight. So, but, you know, so I guess I pose the question to you. So the NFL in the last 5 years, what's the major change that you see that is the big change that you see as far as, and how will that relate to the high school game down the road?
I mean, two things. The first one will sound esoteric, but I'll explain it. But there's no more rules in the NFL for offense. And what I mean by rules is there were these unwritten rules when I came in the league that you had to have an attached tight end. You had to have a fullback. You know, you had to line up in certain formations just because that's what everybody did. Right. And then the Saturday, Friday, Saturday, it started taking looking over and they said, no, you don't. You can play 10. Oh, you know, you can run tunnel screens. You can RPO. You can, you know, not block people and read them. Are you kidding me? Like, really, you can do that? Man, yep, you can do it. Oh, you can throw a sidearm. You can sprint to the right hash and throw it back to, I mean, all of a sudden, just all these unwritten rules went away because the college influence kind of took over the NFL. And it just became such a better game. It became so much more creative. It became so much more open. They still run the football. I mean, the biggest lie ever is that you can't run the football from these spread looks.
And that's
you just got. You just got to protect them, right? I mean, you just got to protect the runs. So they started learning how to protect the runs. So that's the biggest thing in the NFL. And I think with high schools, what you're going to see is, I get why, you know, we play some teams that are metro teams that have to run, you know, power stack or wing tee or whatever. But I even think that's going to change. I think, you know, it's more fun to throw the ball around and spread it out and play more skill position guys and not play in the scrum. And I think you're going to see even more and more high school teams doing what you've been doing forever, what we're doing here, which is, you know, open it up. You know, don't say no to ideas and really develop these kids completely as football players on the offensive side of the ball, especially, and it puts so much pressure on defenses. And I'd say the second thing is the limited padded practices, the limited contact, all the safety protection, player protection concerns. Tackling just isn't as good, especially open field tackling. So, one, as a head coach, how do you make sure your team doesn't suffer, that you're good at tackling, that you're not one of those teams people say, oh, they can't tackle, so we can take advantage of them. So that's the first challenge. And then two, how do you offensively create that conflict for teams that you know don't get to practice tackling that much, that aren't that physical, that aren't getting after it, that are worried that you know, are overly concerned with injuries and kids being banged up. How do you take advantage of that? So, it's something I think about constantly. Are we tackling enough? We do tackling drills every practice, no matter what.
Yep.
We're live for a few periods, no matter what, because we want to be a good tackling team. But then we'll also study our opponents and be like, oh, they don't tackle much in practice. You can tell. So let's make sure we maybe play more in space this week. We don't want them to have help. So maybe that's a week your big formation into the boundary to make sure you can spit the ball to the field. And in Tennessee, these hash marks are like, it's like parting the Red Sea. They're so far apart. You know, you can get over there and take advantage of the field and make a guy that we know maybe tackled for 5 minutes in an entire week. Make him go tackle our best player for 48 minutes, and that's a huge advantage for us.
You know, I watched not only did I watch it, Trent, I even broke it down. Because that's what I do, is I take offenses and of opponents, and I'll break the offense down, and then I'll give a synopsis to the defense coordinator or the head coach, whoever asked me to do that. So I just curiously, the team that I'm working with part-time is UAB, and we don't play LSU or we don't play Alabama, but I was curious. So I broke it down just like if we were playing them in 2 weeks. And, I watched that game and I looked at LSU because I wanted to know, because I really hadn't, when you're in your own little deal, you really don't have time to look at a lot of other people. You know how that goes.
Yep.
And you're finding that out right now. So I was curious. We had a little time and I was called up and I looked at it. And, it's very simple. It's, what LSU is doing is not rocket science. It's not something that's new. First, it's Joe Burrow's at quarterback that's really good. They got great receivers. But the scheme is pretty good, and they go partially tempo in the right time that puts people in contrast and in conflict. But it's crossing routes. It's overage routes. It's the simple stuff that – high school. Oh, I did. I saw a decline in high school football in the mid to late 90s. Because here's what happened. What happened was, and you're probably smarter than me getting into it. You've sort of experienced it, so you've probably jumped into it way better than I have. But I saw a decline overall because every coach in high school football in Alabama at that time would bring your kids in. You'd lift in the morning. You'd lift in the afternoon. You could make either one. And you'd lift them hard in the weight room, and then you'd take them out and run the mess out of them. I mean, just run. Well, the decline, AAU basketball, baseball. So kids, the athletes were leaving the sport. So I think with the passing game, you take the best athlete and you put him at your quarterback. You'll find some skilled guys either on the basketball court or the baseball diamond. And you can spread the football around and equal distribution. And all of a sudden it becomes fun because now we created 7-on-7 game. Because I got tired of going to colleges and playing speedball. And or you would have, they wouldn't have officials out there and people were just running around because they were in evaluation mode. So, but what happened was in the state of Alabama is everybody started running 7-on-7s, and we had a huge one at Hoover, probably the biggest one in the country at the time in 2001 and 2, 3, 4, and 5. And we brought in Evangel Christian. We brought in some really good teams that could throw the football, and it caught on. But what it did, though, Trent, is it made it fun for the players, and they were still getting in work. So now, flip forward from 1997, 96, 97 to 2005, basically, you were lifting, but then you went and practiced. So you were getting 33, 34, 35 practices in, and you could sell your kids on, hey, we're not going to condition today if you give me everything you can as a practice concept. Man, you talk about buying in, they bought in, and I think it spread in so many different areas. It made it fun for kids, so we didn't start losing kids to AAU anymore, or kids wouldn't come in your office and say, you know, coach, this is boring, you know, so I'm going to stick with baseball. I got a chance at the draft. You know, they would say, hey, I like this. So it became fun to them. And I think that's where the Kyler Murrays and the Patrick Mahomes, you know, you take a great athlete, you stick them at quarterback, they can do a lot of things, and then it becomes fun. And guess what? Now you've got a pretty good thing going on, and I applaud a lot of people that were, you know, and you know where it all goes back to. Lavelle Edwards, Bill Walsh in the West Coast, and the things that he did with Joe Montana, you studied it. It created the throwing game and the passing game became fun. Crap, I remember people in the early 90s still getting in a three-point stance at wide receiver, and you do too.
So, no doubt.
So the game has become way fun, and I know that you, so as you go forward, you're going to be on the cutting edge on a lot of things because of your exposure. So what's your next move? What will you do now that you've instilled an offense? You've instilled, it seems to me, a strength and conditioning coach, the nutrition, tremendous facilities. Now what's next? What's going to be the cutting edge for Trent Dilfer that, hey, what can I do that nobody else is doing that gives me an edge to win?
I don't think I'm there yet. I would love to have some creative answer for you, and I'm wrestling with a couple things, but I'm also, and this is probably why you're one of the most successful coaches of all time, you also know when you just need to do what you're doing right now better.
Yep.
And I think our next step is ownership. I've talked a lot to the kids about, you know, learning, then knowing, then understanding, but then owning it. And I think we're still kind of in the knowing, understanding phase, but we don't own it. It's not ours. Not every, you know, there's not that, they're not reading each other's minds out there. They still have to over-communicate to be on the same page. When we get to the point where we're doing what we're doing and they know, all of them know each other so well, and they know the stuff so well, and they know the purpose and the why behind what we're doing it, then I think there's an opportunity to do something pretty creative that I've been wrestling the list for a while. But until we get there, I don't want to cheat the process. And I think we're probably a year away. We have a bunch of talented kids who are now pursuing us and want to be part of our program that are coming in and, you know, teaching them the foundational stuff. And once we get to that ownership state with this next group of kids, then I think there are some things that can be pretty innovative that can give you an advantage, especially in the kicking game. I think the kicking game's the next place to go for really innovation, where you're constantly on the attack but yet still sound, because I am a field position guy, so I don't ever want to sacrifice field position. But I do think there's some things in a kicking game you can be really creative with and stay aggressive. But I want to get this offensive, defense, and core special team stuff down first and make sure we're really good at it.
Well, I guess one of my last questions is going to be, so, and we may have talked about it already, but okay, so it's this week, it's going to be colder.
Yep.
You could experience rain. So how does that affect, and what's your plans for, and I know you're experiencing the NFL, and it's got to have helped you from a standpoint of January football is just completely different than what it is in September and October.
So everybody wants to run the ball in November, right? Everyone in the NFL wants to be able to run it in playoff time. Wanting to and knowing how to are two very different things. And maybe it's not running, but being safe with the football. Because you can, in today's spread offenses, you can throw the ball at the line of scrimmage. There's a lot of creative ways of throwing it, too, that's safe with bad field conditions and bad weather conditions. But basically, you want to have a ball control mentality. And I think what we've really built up to this point is we know how we want to run it. And we can run it a lot of different ways. Now, we're still going to throw it on early downs. We're still going to try to stay balanced. But we're not just going to get in two backs and run the same formation to run it at you. You know, we're going to shift and motion and move and change personnel to create angles and give them a lot of different looks in the run game. And I always say this. You want the defensive coordinator calling the defense to have pause. Because at the end of the day in high school football, unless you just have war daddies, you have to guess to a certain degree on your defensive calls to stop a really good run team. So we want him guessing wrong. And when he thinks he's slanting field to take away trap, we want to make sure we're in an outside zone away from the slant. You know, and we want to make sure we have an extra hat that we're recruiting around, maybe wrapping him around for the alley defender. So we maybe have a two-on-one situation. Our wide receivers, we're really, really physical on the perimeter blocking. Be not always blocking the corner. You know, sometimes it's better to crack on the outside backer because our guys are physical and tough kids, and we'll do that and leave our back one-on-one with a corner who's, you know, zone dropping to 12 yards and he really doesn't want any, has no interest in tackling. Maybe it's just creating a slight little overshift for their backers, plussing them over to be able to run so they have bad angles. But we have a lot of ways we're going to be able to run the football. We're going to be able to action pass off any of it if they, you know, when I say go into casino mode, where they're all in on stopping the run, we want to take advantage of that. And then I'm a huge believer, and I will never relent on this, that you have to have a really good must pass package, and you got to own that package. So base passing game and must pass basing game are two very different things from a protection standpoint, from a progression standpoint. What defenders you're trying to activate, how your concepts can maybe go against two-man, cover three, and zero. Do you have answers for whatever they do in a third and eight situation? So we work really hard every week, and that's usually my fingerprint on the offense is okay, when we get into a must-pass situation, who are we trying to get the ball? What answers do we have to what they're doing? And number one, can we protect it? Because we don't want them to have a game wrecker that just ruins third down for us. This week we play against a great three technique. He's the best three technique I've seen in Tennessee. So the whole week is, you know, how are we going to handle the three? You can draw me up all the greatest plays in the world, but if we can't handle this war daddy at the three technique, you know, so are we going to thump them? Are we going to double team them? Are we going to action pass them and maybe trap them in pass protection schemes? Are we going to screen at them? How early are we going to screen at them? Are we going to screen away from them? you know, there's a lot of things you got to do the mental gymnastics through with the staff to make sure one guy doesn't ruin your game.
Yeah, well, you know, Dan, you can tell that Trent Dilfer knows this game inside and out, and it would be a privilege for my children and my kids. I have four boys, Trent, and I have my youngest are, I have a 15-year-old and a 12-year-old that, you know, they're not real big, but, you know, they love the game of football. But it would be a privilege to have my kids play for you, because I just think you've got the whole package. And it sounds like that you have created a vacuum at your school, in the community, and in that area. And, you know, and you have to be very careful. I know that I have been labeled before as a guy that recruits and this, that, and the other. But, you know, it's not that you're recruiting. It's because your program is so good and you have so much to offer. Kids will come. Kids will move in. And kids will come play. You know, if somebody hears this interview tonight, and because I would. I mean, if I'm not going to get back into coaching, which I am, but I would want my, after me talking to you tonight, and I know your past history, I would want my 15-year-old ninth grade son to play for Trent Dilfer, because I know he's going to get the full package.
Well, Coach, I can't tell you, it gives me chills. I can't tell you how much that means to me. You're a legend. I would love for you to mentor me, to be honest with you. There's still a lot of stuff I haven't figured out, and I want to know it all. I want to give these kids, like you said, I just want, it's not even the kids. I always says, I want the family to have the greatest experience that they could possibly have ever imagined. I had a family sit down. Unfortunately, we had a kid move across state for a senior year play for me. Really talented player. Had a sesamoid fracture and has missed, you know, really most of the season. He hasn't been himself. It's really sad because they really made a sacrifice to move across the state. He really was, he was starting to get recruited. He felt like this would be a huge thing for him. So it's been really disappointing. They sat on my couch yesterday and said we would not change a thing. Our entire family would not change one thing. This has been the greatest experience of our lives. And this is a kid that didn't have a great football experience. He's been hurt. And that meant so much to me, because I just want to create an atmosphere where families have an incredible experience, that the kid gets all the human development he can get. And we do that, then I think we're naturally going to win a lot of football games. I think a lot of people are going to want to come be part of our community, and that'll be awesome. That'll be the icing on the cake. But if anybody knows my story, you know my inspiration is I lost a 5-year-old son. He was our second, and I really do look at this as a second chance of parenting boys. And doesn't mean I'm soft on them. Doesn't mean, you know, I baby them. But I'm trying to see each one grow up to be the best man they can be, and again, I think, and you can tell me otherwise, but I think the winning will take care of itself if we do that.
You do, and create, in today's world too, and I know we're in rural Georgia, and the last 11 years I've spent, we've had 136 kids play or go on and sign college scholarships, and, you know, I've got 46 kids playing college football right now, and two playing in the NFL, one starting for Kansas City, Cam Irvin, and then Jamias Pittman with the Dolphins. But we created these kids had no way out. They're in a rural, suppressed area, farming, cultural divide here. And so these kids, if they graduate from high school, there was no job. So they went to work for the local plants and where they bring in produce, and they had miserable lives, and poverty was everywhere. So their only way out for a lot of these kids were football. So it does give you self-gratification to me for those kids to go on and get an education. And because I keep up with all of them, and we sort of did the grid sheet. Okay, I've been here 11 years. I've got two. There's been two kids, you know, three that have been invited to camp. One's on the practice squad. One's a starter. But the rest of them, you know, it's that college education and what you do with that college education. So we hammer and pound that from this area. Now, at Hoover, it was different in the fact, Trent, because most of 98% of kids went to college. Regardless of football. But on. It's a kid that's had trauma in his life, or had issues, or they're going to have issues. You know, every kid has an issue. There's never been that perfect kid. If there had, I can count them on one hand in 38 years I've done this. You know, so you deal with that. But to me, in coaching, and this is, and it sounds like you're going right down the right path, is that that's the fun part about it. Yes, winning will come, you know, and I try to take a mentality to try to forget, with, you know, the losses, and, you know, try to move on, move on. And it's a hard thing to do because you're always second-guessing yourself, but that's the competitor in you. And but what's more gratifying to me is we made signing day here as important as being a state champion. So when you watch those mothers tear up and tears running down their cheeks on signing day, and you have 18, 17, 19, 22, you know, per year, to me, that was bigger than even being, because that trophy's going to get old, and you're not going to see it. You're going to lose your ring, probably, but that education don't go away. So I think that, you know, high school coaches especially, it's a job that takes a lot of work, but, man, you're talking about changing a life, and talking about helping a life, and that's all it is helping kids achieve what somebody did for you, Trent Dilfer, what somebody did for me, influenced me, over and beyond your parents. You know, somebody in the game of football influenced Trent Dilfer just like someone influenced me. So you just want to give it back just like you're doing. So I applaud you. I'm proud that you're in this game. I'm proud that you're doing this and you're in high school football, but I think you're going to make a heck of a lot of differences in a lot of kids' lives over the however long you want to do this.
Plus, Trent, you've always done it with the Elite 11, too, and you're still doing it right now. I think that's pretty remarkable. You've always gave it back.
Yeah, I really enjoy that part of it. You know, I have enough time in the offseason to still be the head coach of that. I don't have to work as tirelessly at it because the staff is so good. We've been doing it 10 years now. But that's still a huge part of it. I love mentoring those quarterbacks. And then the relationships with the Jared Goffs and the Sam Darnolds and the Tuas and the Justin Fields. And I go on to Trevor Lawrence, just on and on and on about how rich those relationships are, because the, you know, 10 to 15 days I get to spend with them as they're getting ready to go face their senior year. So that's still a huge thrill in my life. And guys, I've really appreciated the time tonight. This has been fun. Love to do it again. And can't tell you, Coach, how much I admire you and appreciate you, and would love to do this again.
Last question, Dan, you probably know, and then you can answer real quick. How does, you know Jeremy's my guy, and I believe in him. So you being in Tennessee, what's the Tennessee fan base that's around you? What's your thoughts on the Tennessee football program today?
Well, it's obvious. I mean, what I tell people, because I watch it, is they're tougher. They're better coached. They're more physical. They're smarter. Like, it's a smart football team. They still don't have all their folks they need. I think it's going to take them a couple more years to, you know, get the ammunition, so to speak. But they play a good style of football, smart style of football. They're well coached, like I said, and you can see the toughness. I mean, that's the biggest thing to me, is it jumps out under Jeremy's leadership how much tougher they are. And that'll go along. That is probably the number one thing in the SEC, is you better be physically, mentally tough to go through the rigors of the SEC. And that's what I tell people. I think people are starting to see it. I do think that fan base, their expectations are a little too high. I think give him a couple more years and he'll get this thing right where he wants it.
No question. Again, thanks for doing this tonight for Dan and me, and we will see you down the road.
All right, guys. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you, Trent.